Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
Hola. Hola. Eco? Eco? Hola? Hola?
¿Sois vos? ¿Sois vos? ¡Habéis regresado! No, no os asustéis, os lo ruego. Mirad, mirad.
Mi nombre es Ofelia. ¿Quién eres tú?
¿Yo? Yo he tenido tantos nombres. Nombres viejos que solo pueden pronunciar el viento y los árboles. Yo soy el monte y el bosque y la tierra. Soy un fauno.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 2006 film Pan's Labyrinth. The film was written and directed by Guillermo del Toro, and here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Vince B.
Hello.
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. So, Vince, let's continue on with what I always say whenever it's one of the guys from 11 o'clock is let's do the segment that I directly ripped from you guys. What are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking coffee.
Mm.
Yes.
It's just straight black, right?
Oh yeah. Nothing else in it.
You don't need a little diuretic help with some creamer or anything.
No. And here's a little bit, peer behind the curtain. A lot of times when I say I'm drinking beer on the show, I'm drinking coffee.
Oh, spoilers.
I do love my Java.
Dunkin' Donuts?
Doesn't matter. This is McDonald's.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's my personal favorite. It's cheap and it's really good.
There you go. Surprising.
Like me.
Yeah. Cheap and really good. I like that. I was tinkering with going something with a little Spanish flair today.
Would have been appropriate, right?
I figured as much. Yeah. I kind of wussed out. And so I'm not going with the grapefruit vodka, which has been the standby as of late, but I am going with a screwdriver, just with some OJ and some vodka.
Very nice.
Yeah, excellent. Just keeping it simple, you know.
Yep.
That and I was like, oh, I forgot. Gotta get a drink. I'll just make this real fast. So with that, I think we're ready to begin our discussion on the 2006 film, Pan's Labyrinth.
In a dark time, when hope was bleak, there lived a young girl whose only escape was in a legend that wanted her back. Legend speaks of the lost soul of a princess from another world who will one day be reborn. There will be signs that mark her return.
Thank you.
And the IMDb plot synopsis is not bad. I've been a little choosier from IMDb as of late, and so this one's not too bad, but it goes as follows. Pan's Labyrinth is the story of a young girl who travels with her pregnant mother to live with her mother's new husband in a rural area up north in Spain. 1944, after Franco's victory, the girl lives in an imaginary world of her own creation and faces the real world with much chagrin. Regression during the first years of Franco's dictatorship is what that should be, is at its height in rural Spain, and the girl must come to terms with that through a fable of her own. Okay, so the end wasn't written so well. And I do like keeping those in there word for word, so it's not me stumbling because I can't read. It is me stumbling because of how poorly written it is. So, Mr. Vince, tell me about you and Pan's Labyrinth. What is your history with Guillermo del Toro's film?
I originally saw this in the theater when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
My initial reaction was, oh, masterpiece. And I think my appreciation of the film has only compounded with age. I think the script is incredibly tight. The events, everything plays off everything else. There is nothing in this film that's extraneous.
Mm.
I wish, and this is a dig at the film you knew I really didn't like when it first came out, but I've warmed to it to a certain degree. if he brought the artifice and the skill and just the magnificent forethought that he brought to Pan's Labyrinth to Pacific Rim, I can only imagine what that film would have been. I mean, it was okay. It's one of those, yeah, let's waste a couple hours. But Pan's Labyrinth is a really affecting, incredibly moving piece of cinema. I just adore this movie for a ton of reasons I hope we'll get to discuss.
And it's it's also disturbing.
Is that's one of the things I like about the film is there is a profound sadness that just pervades the entire film from beginning to end. It starts off with death. The whole film is predicated on a myth of the princess of the underworld who dreams of the mortal realm. Right. And she ventures to the surface, is blinded by the sun, something she's never seen before, blinded by the sun, but also her memories are bleached. She doesn't know who she is or where she came from, and she dies. And the king of the underworld, orders all the beings under him, let's open up these portals because I know my daughter's essence is going to return, and we have to be ready. We have to have these portals open so when her essence comes back, she'll return to us. So it starts off with death and loss and grieving, and it just gets worse from there. I mean, the backdrop of the Spanish sequences in 1944 is war, which is horrible enough, right? But it's not only that, it's civil war.
Mm-hmm.
So you have not an enemy, this strange culture from another country, people whose customs you don't understand. You're fighting in a civil war. You're fighting against your own people, your blood. You can be shooting at the guy from down the street. And it's just a terrible, terrible situation. War is bad enough, but civil war is even worse.
Yeah, that does make a huge difference, because if this was set, say, in modern day middle America, right, it doesn't have the same sort of impact as it does in the 40s in Franco's reign in Spain. Right. And so I think that, I mean, besides the fact with Guillermo del Toro being, being very familiar with the subject matter, I think that does make a big impact. And I do like the fact that when I first saw this, I saw it, I was just, well, I guess not just out of college. That's BS. I was going to say I was in out of college, but I was a few years out and just cheap essentially still, which was going to be my excuse, but I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it right when it came out on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And so I checked it out, and I was really sort of struck by the fact that I didn't know a lot about what was going on in the Spain aspect of it.
Right. Yeah, myself too. I had a little bit of research mm-hmm. on that.
Yeah. And so my research consisted of watching it straight through and leaving it in the DVD player and watching it again with Del Toro's commentary on.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me was, you know, he was just kind of talking about things like we would say, you remember when Kirby and Lee did such and such on Fantastic Four? It's just like, it was just another second language to him.
Right.
And for me, that was all new information. So I was just gathering all of the pieces that I could. And I really liked the film as well. I hadn't seen it in a few years, which is one of the things that I've kind of been doing on these recent Podshot episodes where I've been choosing or suggesting films that I own, but I haven't seen in a little while. And I'm like, oh, you know, I really like that movie. And then rewatching them and seeing if I actually really do like them or if I am not as overwhelmed as I used to be or if my appreciation has deepened for them. And in this case, I think that I appreciated it a lot more than I used to. And I really, really liked it the first time that I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think? You know, one of the things that we are currently doing here at the household is my girlfriend is in a children's literature class at the university. And so we're reading a lot of Once Upon a Time
sort of
films. What do you think about it opening up like that? Like you were saying about the, about opening up in the Princess of Death and all of that. Do you think that that's a crucial aspect of the film, or do you think it could have opened up in Spain, or what do you think about that?
No, I think the fairy tale preface is very important to the film mm-hmm. because, like I said, you have the princess of the underworld who dreams of the mortal realm, which is juxtaposed against Ophelia, who basically lives in a fantasy realm. She reads fairy tales incessantly. She's a dreamer. She's a very bright child, but she sees magic in everything, where the princess of the underworld is alive in this, well, so to speak, in this realm of magic, and she longs for this mortal realm. So you have he does the flip.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically, can we go into spoilers?
Oh, absolutely. There's never been a Podshot show that's not spoiler filled.
Okay. They're basically the same character.
Yeah.
Only like the mirror image of each one. And I think that's crucial to the film.
Well, I think it's also important that the captain is an opposite of hers as well.
Right. Right.
Because his world that he's living in is not crucial to the overall Civil War.
No.
Right? So he's living in his fairy tale.
Right. And he's weighed down by it too.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's living in the shadow of his father, who from that dinner sequence when he introduces his wife to all his I'm assuming family and you know friends, he's basically, you could tell that the father's well regarded because he was a general.
Yes.
And he proceeded through the army and he was regarded as a noble man. And Captain Vidal, I don't think he's regarded well by anyone, including himself. No, he's a sadistic, brutal. He's a pig
mm-hmm.
and he's a butcher. I don't get the feeling through the events of the film that he's anything other killing people, you know, doing it because he's just taking orders. The one part that really surprised me was the doctor's reply to him when he said about taking orders but questioning them. Like, that's life. If you don't question orders, what good are you? And the captain questions nothing. He maims and kills and you know, just because that's the lot he's been given by the army. This is what you do, and you will achieve your goal. And he's just thinking, maybe I'm doing something wrong here. Maybe these people don't deserve to be killed.
Yeah, it seems like at one point the captain in his life, and this is just me guessing, but it seems like he had thought, well, maybe I'm not getting the recognition, or maybe I'm not getting to the place where my father did yet because I'm not going far enough.
Right, right.
And because he's definitely crossed that line.
Right.
You know, to where he'll do anything.
And he, in the film for himself that, you know, you discover my, and I do not think he likes himself very much.
No, I don't think he likes himself either, because they do make a point of him continually looking in the mirror, right?
Right. And, which is the highlight of which is the straight razor scene.
Yes.
Where he's shaving and he pretends to cut his own throat in the mirror.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Like he repulses even himself, because he knows he's never going to live up to his father's, magnitude. So he, you know, self-loathing, right?
Right.
And then that self-loathing he takes out on others. And one of the scenes that really gets me, and I think it pretty much defines the character of the captain, who is a really interesting guy, other than the fact that he's a sadistic bastard.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's incredibly complex, but in a certain area. So his men find these, a father and son hunting out in the woods. And of course he's got to interrogate them, because there is a possibility that they could be, you know, the rebels, the enemy, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And the son does not know when to shut up, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
It's one of those situations where it's too much information sounds like a lie.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, with kids, I'm sure you can relate to that.
Mm-hmm. And he's incredibly insistent, and only mm-hmm. to back up the claims of his father, who he obviously honors. If my father says we're doing this, that's what we were doing, and the captain's not having it. Mm-hmm. So he finds a bottle of something within their little satchel that they've commandeered.
Yeah, I think it's wine.
Wine, and he bludgeons the son to death with the bottle. And the thing that really got me is that Del Toro's camera in this instance is unflinching.
Mm.
It lingers what seems to be forever, just like bam, bam. And the special effects are really good, because you can, and the sound too.
Oh yeah.
The crunch of the kid's bones, and just that the bottom of the bottle just mashing the face in, and it's relentless. It's like the single white knuckle instance in the film, and it gets me every time.
I know that you had mentioned that, and you're like, and that's coming from me. You know?
Yeah, well, I've seen some pretty horrific stuff.
Sure.
And yeah. It's just, I mean, given the films that I like to watch.
Yeah, and that's something that for me really was, I think that it's the combination of the bottom of a wine bottle. Right. That glass is so dense.
Mm-hmm.
You just even handling it, you know, you're just like, oh man, this is a really sturdy object. So it's the combination of that for me. And it's in the middle of your face on your nose is where he hits him first.
Right. Right.
And it's just like the most vulnerable part of your face really mm-hmm. is that nose, eyes area. And he just bashes him, and the ease in which it turns into like a cavity.
Right.
Really is disturbing. And I remember. When we watched this for the recording, you know, Anel was real squeamish and turned to the side and was kind of unexpected, like, oh God, I forgot about this. Like, yikes. Yeah.
And even if you turn away, the sound, mm-hmm. the audio mm-hmm. is just, oh, it's stomach turning. But another thing, it wasn't even a fair, I don't want to call it a fight, but the captain didn't play fair. He cold cocked the guy when the guy didn't expect it, dazed him. And then, because the guy was dazed, he took it upon himself to finish the job, as, to a certain extent, kills the father, and then just, you know, turns to the son, doesn't get him the first time with the first shot. He misfires and gets him, you know, below the neck, and then the second shot goes through the head and he takes him out. But if you notice, compare that scene to other similar scenes in the movie where the doctor's cutting off the guy's leg, because it's all gangrene and just disgusting. You barely see the blade go in. And it's just like a split second. Del Toro doesn't linger. And there are other, even when Mercedes has the knife in the captain's mouth and takes out his cheek, you see it for a couple seconds, but the camera does not linger anywhere near as long.
Yeah, there's no glory in it.
No, so you got to wonder, that sequence must be really important to Del Toro to convince you that, you know, obviously this guy is a butcher, but...
I think it's really important because it's that first real violent incident. And so from then on, I remember every time watching the film, just every time I see the captain, I'm like, oh shit, he's such a dangerous person because he's willing to go to lengths that I don't consider.
And,
you know,
and completely without emotion. There's nothing on his face when he's bashing that guy.
Now, what do you think about the fact that they were out rabbit hunting? To me, I think that really kind of teeters on the line of being too much because it doesn't add anything to me. How do I want to say this? I think that whether they were actually out doing that is sort of secondary. And I think by the fact that they were telling the truth, it teeters to gratuitous then to me.
See, I'll have to disagree with you on that one because the fact that the captain pulls the rabbits out of the satchel and then scolds his men for not being thorough enough.
Uh-huh.
You're the top of the food chain. You should be the one being thorough. Your men are just basically servants. So in a sense, the captain in this sequence anyway is borderline inept because he wasn't thorough enough. He should have looked through that entire bag before he
took action.
Right. Before he took a life, he took a human life based on something, you know, he could not have been true.
Sure. But doesn't it hold true to his character to where he's following orders, right? The men said this. So he's just sort of a weapon.
Right. And let's be honest. I think those guys were dead either way.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like I would have preferred, you know, putting on the rider hat. I would have preferred if he looks in a bag, doesn't show the audience what's in there, and then goes and chews the ass. Because then you can think, well, is it or isn't it? And that just seems more interesting to me personally, as opposed to showing you that it clearly was a wrong on his part. Because that just seems, that to me, and maybe they're doing it because of the fairy tale to where everything has to be clearly one way or the other. Clearly either good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to that, makes him a little less complicated to me, to where it's clearly showing you that he's a bad person and a bad guy.
Right. And I think the rabbits, I mean, that's not the only part in the story they play, because the captain holds more reverence for the rabbits than he does for those two human beings, because he gives them to Mercedes and he's like, cook these, you know, like as if he's giving her a gift, like, please cook these.
Yeah.
And she's like, they're a little too young. I don't think they'll taste good. No. You can find something to do. And that's another aspect about the captain I find intriguing. He's incapable of caring for himself. He doesn't cook his own food. He doesn't do his own laundry. He has guys all around him, just like lackeys to fulfill his every whim. He's inept. I think there's an ineptitude to this guy where he goes the distance only because he doesn't want to fail. Like those two guys could have been insurgents so as not to fail in the task of removing the insurgents. He kills them anyway. Like, okay, maybe they were, maybe they weren't, but now there's no question. They're dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I hate the captain, but I just find him so fascinating.
Yeah, I think he's really interesting. What do you think about, let's talk about the watch since we're on the captain.
Mm-hmm.
There's the instance where, you know, the recurring theme is where he wants to honor his father. He supposedly knows the time that his father died because the watch stopped working. And it shows his arrogance or self-importance to fix the watch.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right? And so he fixes it, and so then towards the end of the film, and like we said, spoilers, when he knows he's about to die, he wants the son to know his name, and he wants to know when he died. Right? Okay. It makes me wonder, though, he keeps looking at the watch. Do you think that that is a sense of mortality that he has? Or, and this is a little more into the fairy tale of it, I was starting to wonder, watching it this time around, if it was not actually fixed. And if it was in his own mind going and continuing on and showing new times to where he could have that in his fantasy that his son would know the time of his death, sort of like how Ophelia has all of her different fantastical things that happen.
Right. Yeah. Well, you have to admit, reality is a very malleable thing in this film. There's really no certainty. You can't say Ophelia's fantasy escapades played out exactly as filmed. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but we're, for the sake of the story, I'm going to assume that they did.
Okay.
I think one of the important things with the watch is midway through the film, when they slaughter that pack of rebels.
Yes.
They're behind the trees, and his lackey is very reluctant to get involved in it.
Oh, yes.
He's like, come on, there's no better way to die than this. He's got that watch out.
Yes.
And he looks at it before he enters the fray, thinking, well, if this is my time, I have this watch in my hand, and I'm going to smash this bitch when I know there's no other way out. So he's ready to die. I mean, you say that about him. There's a sense of bravery only to fulfill the obligation he thinks he has to his dad, just to further that bloodline or the mythology of the bloodline. And another thing that gets me about him is that he sees Carmen, his new wife.
Yeah, Ophelia's mother.
Mm-hmm. Right. He sees her as nothing more than a way to perpetuate his bloodline. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's having a difficult time with the pregnancy. If it wasn't for Ophelia putting the mandrake root under the bed in the prescribed manner that the Fawn told her to do it, who knows? Maybe the woman would have died earlier than she did. So, I mean, the child is born, but when he's talking to the doctor, he's like, if you have a choice, if you have to make a choice, you save the child. So the woman is nothing more than a container.
Right. She's a carrier, yes.
Yeah, and so it's all about the legacy with this dude. So realizing the life you're living, which is under the shadow of your father, and all the pain and heartache and bullshit it's causing you, you're going to bestow that life on another human being? He just doesn't care.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if, during the film, before the ending, if he thinks that no matter what it is that he does, as long as he keeps that watch secure with him, mm-hmm. he can sort of have free reign to do whatever, right? It's almost like he has that. Yeah, it's almost like he has a death wish, to where that he could have a little bit of legend behind him, so mm-hmm. his son at least can think of him as a great man.
But what has he accomplished at the moment of his death? Not much. Nowhere near the legacy of his father, who supposedly saved a bunch of men, and the songs have been sung about the dad,
mm-hmm.
and he's gained this reputation. Whereas the son, he has none. His reputation is one of brutality. His men are afraid of him.
Yeah.
You know, his wife and stepchild and servants, they all can't stand him. They think he's a despicable subhuman monster. So that's his legacy.
I do like that he's not a buffoon though.
He figures out
that the train cars hadn't been robbed. And mm-hmm. that the medicine cabinet, the lock hadn't been forced.
Right.
You know, I like that he figures that out, to where he's a fairly intelligent guy. He is very vain, and, you know, obviously they play with that with slashing his face. And I think that I don't know. I really enjoy the fact that he's not just an idiot that right. goes and is just, you know, beating people and killing people. And...
Right. Yeah, that's a nice layer too. Right. I especially like the vanity aspect of it, but I don't think it's a, I think it's more of a military vanity because he's shaving even when he doesn't have to.
Yeah.
It's all about, yeah. No, really. And you hear the scrape and it's like, there is not one whisker on that guy's face. But no, so he's putting on, he's perpetuating this image that he thinks he needs to, show people. And it's for naught because it doesn't help or hinder his cause either way. He's already established what he is with those around him. And, you know, polishing shit is not going to make it smell any better.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I don't know. We haven't really touched on the fantasy aspect.
Yeah, let's move to the fantasy. What do you think about that? I mean, obviously you had intimated that you are a believer, right? I guess there would be two camps.
Right.
Whether it, things that are happening in Ophelia's mind or in her perspective are or maybe are not happening.
No, I definitely think they are. Okay. Just basically because I'm far more enamored with the fantasy aspect of the movie other than the mundane, you know, plight. I hate to call it mundane, but it's real world.
Yeah, so, you know, let me interrupt you here real quick, Vince. I think that what's interesting about that is I was all about the Fawn and the Pale Man and all of that the first time I saw it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I watched it again this time and I wasn't overwhelmed by the human aspect, but I was a lot more taken by it than I had originally remembered.
Right. Well, and, because you know, the designs are so strong.
Mm-hmm.
The Fawn is just magnificently designed, and you can tell that the ghost of Mignola from Del Toro's previous film, which sure. was Hellboy, you look at the spirals on the thing's foreheads. I mean, that is just pure Mignola.
Oh, and when her blood goes to the concentric circles,
mm-hmm.
and when it yep. drips to the circles at the end, yeah.
Yeah. So he was still working on the fumes of his previous film, but just the sculpting of the face, and Doug Jones does a great Ooh. Job.
Man.
Yeah.
And that initial reveal, even though I know it's coming, if I'm not paying attention, that Fawn turn gets me almost every time.
And the twitch.
Oh, yeah, the twitching throughout. Mm-hmm. That was the thing that Anel, watching it, was like, God, it's really upsetting me whenever he moves around like that.
Yeah, he's definitely not of the mortal realm. I mean, there's his movements, his speech, just the way his face, and I think it's just a masterful design on that creature. They had to really knock that out of the park because it's basically the centerpiece of the film. And one thing that gets me is when people, you know, don't do their homework and think that the Fawn is Pan.
Oh, I was just thinking about bringing that up.
Yeah, the two are not, they're connected, but the Fawn is not Pan. I mean, if you look at your mythology, the Romans for, you know, they associate Pan with the Fawn. They were buddies.
Right.
And so what you see in the labyrinth is Pan's emissary. You never ever see Pan.
Well, do you wish it would, you know, cause in Spanish, it's the labyrinth of the Fawn.
Right, right. I think that's what has some people confused. So if it's in Spanish, the labyrinth of the Fawn, and so the translation to Pan's labyrinth, so they might think, okay, I guess the Fawn is Pan, but he's not.
Yeah.
He's not. But the spirit of Pan is alive in this entire movie. I mean, Pan is the god of that savage, unfettered, nature, the wilds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, often associated with, Satanism, not in the, you know, ooh aspect of it, but the, you know, that the spirit, the, you know, do as thou wilt, that should be preeminent. Don't, take, you know, dogma literally. Question it. Think for yourself. That's what Pan, and that is a theme of this movie, and it's echoed by the doctor and the you know, the captain's actions. It's like, question things.
Mm-hmm.
Try and peer behind the curtain. But the labyrinth is magnificent. Oh man, Yeah. I think when you, something you mentioned about the, you know, the human aspect of this movie being more compelling the second time around, I think the performances are great right across the board.
Yeah. You know, someone that I kind of, you know, we talked about the captain. I think he's very good. I think he has, I mean, he's twirling the mustache a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. But I think that, Ophelia is fantastic. She has, you know, the sort of your main child role, but I think that Mercedes is very good in a role that is kind of bland on the page. You know, she's just right. Kind of the caregiver and the, you know, secret, you know, her and the doctor working together to sort of take down the captain. I mean, that's kind of typical in a lot of films that have a setting in a civil war and in some sort of wartime situation. But I think that she plays it very well. What do you think of the fact that, and this is something I always ask whenever it's a foreign language film, what do you think of the fact that, like, how do you judge performance when it's in a different language? Because I find that to be very difficult. I tend to be very lenient on performance when it's in another language because I find myself darting between captions and faces. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, in the native language that they're speaking, it sounds like they're doing a great job all the time,
right? Know,
because
right.
I don't speak the language, so it's like, well, fuck, that sounds great.
Yeah,
you know,
I think it comes down to, well, it's a lot of things: tone, inflection, body language. But the preeminent thing for me is the eyes.
Mm.
You look at Ophelia, that kid at the time of, you know, when this was filmed, look at the soul in her eyes.
Yes.
It's just pure emotion. I think Mercedes has a lot of that too. The lullaby destroys me.
Oh, that is the outro to this episode, everybody.
Yeah. And it's so smartly played because the tune transcends dimensions. He uses it in the beginning when they're going through the litany of the history, you know, of the princess.
Yes.
Then you see it you encounter it somewhat midway through when Ophelia's having a hard time and Mercedes comforts her with the lullaby. And then when Ophelia dies, the lullaby's there. It's devastating how that tune is used in this movie.
Yes. It very much is. It's one of those where I come away from the movie when I first saw it and I thought of two things. I thought of the lullaby and I thought of the character design.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically of the Fawn and the Pale Man.
Yeah.
Were the Pale Man.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the tune transcends dimensions. I think it's not of the mortal realm. And how Mercedes, that's the only lullaby she knew. That there's a part of me that wants to believe that there is an aspect of Mercedes that is also not from the mortal realm, like Ophelia. How would she know that tune? How would she know something that was used as the backdrop, if you can assume that the initial stages of the movie, we're not in the narrative yet. We're somewhere outside of it. We're being introduced to it because all of the scenes that accompany the lullaby in the beginning are not in the mortal realm. And yet the lullaby exists. So how does Mercedes know it?
Well, that makes sense because the mother is there at the end, right?
Right, right.
And the father, who we have only seen at the end. So it would make sense for her to be, for lack of a better word, like a nanny or a caretaker.
Right, right.
Or something of Ophelia.
It's kind of like the, you know, the Wizard of Oz. And you were there, and you were there, and I saw you. And you
like, yeah, okay, a little
so
bit.
So now you've hopped over. But another thing too is, you mentioned the king of the underworld, that's the mirror image of the captain. She has a son of a bitch stepfather in the mortal realm, and in her native realm, her father seems to be, you know, a pretty good guy.
Yeah,
he seems to be an honorable dude because he was praising her for not taking the life of an innocent and sacrificing herself instead.
Yeah, that was her final test, right?
Yes, yeah. Oh, I love it's almost like a golden fleece type thing with the trials of Ophelia. You got to do all these things, you know. We think you are who we assume you are, you know, for you to be this person, you got to do this. And I love how the tasks increase in complexity. Like the toad, you know, it wasn't that hard.
Right? Well, it was fucking disgusting.
It was disgusting. Oh. Yeah. But the Ophelia knew, based on the potato-sized pill bug rolling up in her hand,
yeah.
Hey, that's roughly the same shape as these stones I'm supposed to put in the thing's mouth. And so she used her wits to survive. But one of the things you and I talked about beforehand was Del Toro's short Geometria.
Oh yes, tell me about this.
Well, there's really not a whole lot to tell on the presentation side, like the story side. It's really not all that complex. He did it in 1987, and there's a means to my end here. he did it in 1987. It's basically one of those, you know, time-worn tales of black magic gone really bad. I don't even think it's 10 minutes. But the notable thing about the short was, Del Toro was experimenting with colored lighting techniques. Mm-hmm. He was, very enamored with the work of Dario Argento and, Mario Bava, who both used, colored lights to great effect. Mario Bava better than Dario, but that's neither here nor there. So he picked up on this lighting technique and he, during the short, and there's a commentary that goes along with this short. And he said, if you look at my films, every one after Geometria, I'm playing with the colored lighting. I'm honing my process. And he says on Pan's Labyrinth, you can really see it. Look, watch this sequence again under the tree. Mm-hmm. He has adopted a lighting palette of amber and cyan. And he said, I nailed it down with Pan, and I've been using it ever since.
Okay, I can see that in apparently our favorite movie to talk about, in Pacific Rim.
Oh yeah,
with the Ron Perlman scenes.
Yep, it's in there. Yeah, amber and cyan, and they're a perfect complement. I mean, it just works because it pulls the shadows and it accentuates the highlights really, really well. And you can see that on display in the tree sequence. And there's a lot of that in the movie too, especially in the labyrinth. There's a lot of cold, cyan, but you have your highlights that are screaming. Great. Yeah. I look at the visual aspect first, and then later on I'll get into the story. Like I've seen Pan's, you know, more times than I can count because of that, because I'm so enamored with the visuals, and you kind of lose track of the story when you're paying attention to the actual presentation, that the story to Pan's Labyrinth is so rich that you gotta go back and experience it. There's so much on which to chew in this movie.
Yeah. It's almost like you need to have a perspective each time you go into viewing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to where it's like, okay, today I'm going to go and look at the visuals. So tomorrow I'm going to look at the characters and how complex they are once you start digging at them a little bit.
Right.
You know,
and notice that the exterior shots in Spain, they're really cold.
Yeah.
The overcast, blues, just like Matrix level tweaking with the color, the overall palette of these scenes. But when we get to the underworld, look how bright it is. It sparkles.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
It's alive with it, just like living light. And you would think it to be, this is the underworld just by definition. You know, there shouldn't be a whole lot of light down there, but it's like, the counterpoint, it's the flip again. There's a lot of mirror images in this movie. Great stuff.
Yeah. It is, that's a lot to chew on there, Vince.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do I have in here? I have some good stuff in here. I think that, I love the idea that Ophelia, who's a character we haven't really talked too much about, I love the fact that she, from the get-go, has the imagination that I think most children do, but she does specifically, that she is unique. Mm-hmm. And she is this chosen one, right? And I think that what is interesting about that is so many films we've seen, and most of them being either sci-fi or action films, involve a mundane main character who is the chosen one.
Right.
And they're so often a cipher, and they have zero, you know, they don't have any complex personalities, and they're just supposed to be us. But here, she thinks from the beginning, well, she's different. You know, she's the chosen one. And I think that that's interesting, because she at least has a different perspective right from the beginning. You don't have to deal with all the BS of her being told that she's different.
Right.
You know, when she's in that initial trip in Spain, she goes out and finds the fairy and tells the fairy, this is what you are.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. And I think the one of the things Del Toro was trying to slam home was the most vibrant characters in the entire movie are the ones that question.
Mm-hmm.
Ophelia has a very inquisitive nature. The doctor, Mercedes, it's the dudes that just act on commands that are so boring. Aside from the captain, who, you know, has to be vibrant because he's the villain. Look at all his men, his servants. Nobody questions anything.
Yeah, just completely personalityless. Just, yeah. You know, they don't have any sort of screen presence at all on purpose.
But the rebels do.
Sure.
Because they're questioning the veracity of this new or this regime that's been thrust upon them. This, you know, this isn't right. We got to do something about this. And Mercedes' brother, who's like he just plays a bit part. He's far more interesting than the captain's lackeys. They're just they're just cutouts.
Let me move on to something here, Vincent, and ask you a question. We've referenced the Pale Man before.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, this time in Spain where food is not abundant, and she has this feast in front of her, and she has this time limit, and, you know, and it's one of the little set pieces of the film. And she's supposed to use these fairies, and they're going to instruct her as to which door to unlock.
Right.
And they tell her the middle door, and she goes to unlock that door and realizes that, no, they're not right. It's the first one instead.
Mm-hmm.
And she unlocks that and gets the dagger and, you know, then decides to, you know, give in to her hunger. And then we have the problems with the Pale Man. But what do you think that adds specifically? It always makes me curious, because the dagger is, I guess, representative of her killing her baby brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the life that she would be sacrificing rather than her own. So maybe if they point her towards that that's what they would want, as opposed to her sacrificing herself at the end. So I never have been able to sort of reconcile what it could be in that middle door that they are actually wanting her to go after.
Well, just like you said, the scene with her father at the end, where he reveals that for you to pass the test, you had to sacrifice yourself. That was one of the crucial elements of this thing. For you to be who we think you are, you would have to sacrifice yourself instead of the blood of your brother. I think the Pale Man sequence that the fairies were told to lie. I think they purposely misled her so they would see, oh, she knows which one it is. And that, for another reason, that's why the Fawn told her, listen to me, do not eat anything. I'm being very specific here. Not one molecule of this food must you put into your mouth. He knew she was going to eat it. That was another part of the test, because they were testing her intuition. They were testing her willingness to follow her goals, her ideas to get that. It was a grape. She sacrificed everything for a grape.
Mm-hmm.
And that was definitely part of the plan. He knew she was going to do it. And I don't see anything in the scolding sequence that reveals that he knew, but I'd like to think that that was all part of the plan to begin with. They knew she was going to eat some of the food.
Yeah. What I like about that is I think that there are a few questions in there to where you can say, well, on second and third and fourth and fifth viewings, they're not really giving you any clues that the Fawn knew that, or that the Fawn wanted her to eat just to sort of have the sense of danger, you know, and et cetera, et cetera, and lose some of her fairies and all that. And then it's that, if you're a non-believer, I guess you could say, well, it's all just a bunch of Del Toro having fun because it doesn't actually matter anyway, because this is all just in her imagination. And so what I think is nice about it is, regardless of the sort of viewpoint you have on the film, there is a lot to chew on either way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was given a command.
Mm-hmm.
Don't eat the food.
Yeah.
And she chose to override it. That's one of the themes of the whole movie, right?
Yeah. And it's also nice that it's that that fatherly figure sort of thing as well. It's like, you know, you're supposed to do A, B, and C, and then when your child doesn't, it's like, hey, you can't get away with that.
Right.
You didn't do what you were supposed to do. But whether I'm planting that in there for you specifically to fail in order for you to learn a lesson, that's right. Another thing. But
yeah, but if you remember, the Fawn does get pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
And says, well, you know what? You've just doomed yourself, all of us, that none of our hopes are going to come to fruition. Basically, screw you, I'm out of here.
You'll never see us again.
Right, but he comes back with more than enough time for her to complete that third task. I'm going to give you another chance. You know, BS, you knew this is the way it was going to go down.
When people think that the Fawn is a mysterious character, I was like, well, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because he's being a little mysterious to her, but he knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. I feel like he knows the plan. It's just, you know, he's dealing with a child.
Yeah.
So he can't put all of his cards out on the table.
And he basically cradles her in that one scene when she runs to him and they hug, and you could tell he just the reverence for this child that you know she is who she says. I mean, it's only confirmed at the end, but you have to know.
Yeah. Tell me about your reaction to the Pale Man design.
Ah, it's very disturbing. I see a lot of Marilyn Manson in that character.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole, just his gait, the way he moves. It reminds me a lot of the Beautiful People video.
Wow. That's really funny. I can see that a lot now. Yeah.
Yeah. And the hands on the eyes are really disturbing.
The very exaggerated fingers with the blacked ends.
Mm-hmm. It's a really smart design, but, did you notice, I'm sure you did, the paintings that adorn the wall of his little space? He's just like destroying children.
Yeah. He's a pedophile, essentially, right?
Yeah. Just, some are being stabbed, some are being eaten. There's other things going on there too. So again, it just factors in very nicely with the theme of the, you know, what she was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And why would that character need such a excessive banquet? I mean, he wasn't moving to begin with. He didn't have a mouth, so he can't eat. It's another one of those fairy tale things, like, oh, here's this character, you got to avoid him, so don't eat any of the food. But what is that food doing there in the first place?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just that he knows that the temptation of children that are starving is to eat regardless of the consequences.
Right.
And he does have a mouth because he bites the heads off of those fairies.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah. That's another thing. Whew. And just stretches them.
Ugh. Oh, yeah. I think that what Del Toro does so well is, you know, with the bottle, you expect to have the guy get his nose kind of crunched and you can feel that pain and you're like, okay, well. But he goes to, you know, another level in terms of how graphic it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of unexpected at the same time. And he does the same with the fairies, where you're like, okay, well, he'll just cleanly bite off these heads, or he'll just eat them or whatever. But it's more gruesome than that. And it's not gratuitous. It's just like he bites down on them and then sort of pulls their head off.
Right, right. But to me, it didn't resound anywhere nearly as strong as the bottle sequence.
Oh, because no.
Yeah, they're fantasy creatures.
Sure.
You know, it's like red shirts in Star Trek. You kind of know they're gonna...
I totally forgot
about that he had a mouth with that biting sequence. Good one on you.
Well, yeah. And he's got and what I like about it is when he has the eyeballs in his hands, he has like a wide spread of his hands to where it's not real close. And so when he's got that, it makes the shape of a humongous head.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really off-putting to me. I'm like, oh, I can just feel myself, you know, with my skin crawling, just thinking about those images of him unnaturally walking towards Ophelia. And I don't know that I'm in love with the sort of wild flailing of the arms, but it's a sequence where he's chasing after a girl. So how much, you know, you can't have him be real quick and run after her and get her or something.
Right. Yeah. That disturbed me too, because, if your means of sight are on your hands, you're not going to flail like that.
Yeah. That's what I thought. I was like, well, that's dumb. That's just like whipping your head around.
Right. But when he does spread his fingers, there's a regal aspect to that. Like he's some sort of a king or something of very high stature, because it just looks kingly to me, it forms like a crown type
with the long fingers. It definitely
I like that. That's one thing. Even the frog is extremely well designed too, to the point where that stuff that oozes out of him, that's really disgusting. And because there's bugs jammed in it, just dead bugs.
I thought that was basically his stomach coming out of him.
Right, right, right. Yeah. And another thing about Ophelia, she just reaches in there, I'm gonna get the key, you know?
Yeah.
what child would do that? Like,
especially, she's got those huge roly polies or whatever the hell they're actually called. And, you know, that goes into the ball, and she, you know, it's running on her face, and she's like, doesn't want it on her face, but also isn't, you know, panicking about it by any means. And she's just kind of like, oh, well, I'll just get this dirt all over me and rub this thing off. And
as far as the dirt goes, she was told specifically, do not mess up this dress. This is a very important night for your mother and stepfather. You must look the part. Doesn't care, overrides the orders, and does what she wants to do. That's, again, in with that theme.
I do like the fact that it's a little bit of a, you know, you can see where she's like, oh, it's for my stepdad. Well,
yeah.
Did
you notice that when she's taking a bath afterwards and the mother says, you know, you can't do that. Your father will be, you know, he'll be very, very pissed off.
A little smile.
It's a little smile. She leans back and she's just like, that's right.
Yeah.
I have power over this dude.
Oh, I see that. I see that almost daily.
Yeah.
Don't you do that.
And you're then right.
Do it anyway. A little smile. Like, oh.
I would rather the smile instead of the impassioned glance, like, I own you.
Yeah. Okay. So, moving forward a bit here is I want to talk a little bit about when Mercedes gets the captain's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this a little bit already, but I want to, what do you think of the sequence where he's sewing his face?
Oh. Brutal. Absolutely brutal. I can watch that though. Mm-hmm. My eyes don't leave the screen, whereas with the bottle, I have to look away. Again, Mercedes, she struck a blow to his vanity.
Mm-hmm.
She knocked him down a few pegs. I mean, because she could have stabbed him in the heart. I think she tried to, but she got him up above by the shoulder. And if you have a knife in someone's mouth, And it's a character as despicable as this captain, you would jam it down his throat.
Mm-hmm.
You would take him either that or up into his brain, but she marred his vanity. So in terms of, you know, the best act to unleash from this very, very dangerous enemy, not the best thing to do, but in thematically, it works really well.
Yeah. The only, I don't know if it's issue, but the only thing that I noticed this time that was a little, like a little strange to me is it looked like the way that they did it with the CGI, it looked like it was its own little mouth, the way that they sort of mapped it in there. And it was so clean. Like it wasn't bleeding or anything. You know, it was just like so well treated.
Yeah.
And then he's sewing it up and he puts a bandage on it and then it starts bleeding afterwards. And I'm like, what? Like what?
Yeah,
but that's neither here nor there, really. I mean, I understand the point of it is he's so sickened and sad at that he's having to try to repair his face that it hurts him a lot more than just the physical pain of doing it.
But can you imagine doing that, stitching up this? No, I can't either.
No. No, there's no way. You know, I watched that on TV shows and where people are stitching themselves. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe like on my forearm or something. Sure, I'd be able to do that. But like on your side or in your mouth, no way. I wouldn't be able to do it.
No. And the fact that he does it, I mean, there's strength behind that character, a massive amount of strength, fortitude. He can do that. But it doesn't, in the end, right? It doesn't amount to a whole lot.
Yeah. What do you think of, his, let's stay with the captain. And I guess I'm talking a lot more about the captain than I expected, but what do you think of his sort of decency towards the end where he doesn't try to run off with his son? Do you think that the only reason he's doing that is because he believes that Mercedes will go along with what's clearly his wish in that he will know about the captain and he and the son will know the time of death and all of that? Do you think that that's so implanted in his mind to where she would not not grant him that wish, that that's the reason why he so freely gives up the child? Or do you think that he's just knows that he's screwed and he's just like, well, fuck it.
Well, it plays into the intelligence of the character. I think he pretty much was certain his goose was cooked. Mm-hmm. Had he tried to run away, the chances of the child being killed as well were very, very high.
Yeah.
So, I think it was his only option to prey upon the sympathies of Mercedes and offer the child up. It's basically the only chance he had to perpetuate the bloodline, that legacy. So I don't think there was anything else he could have done. Mm. Look at all those guns that were, he was gone. He exited the labyrinth and was greeted by, let's just say like 20 or 30 guys with guns. You're not getting out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're finished. And the fact that she does not fulfill his wishes, that was perfect.
Yeah, and I love the look on the face, and that it's one of those things where I forget that they're acting, right? Mm-hmm. Like I forget that they know the next line, and that's what I really appreciate about movie making, especially now that I'm teaching and having to, you know, we have some O. Henry books that we're doing or short stories, mm-hmm. and so having to try to sound surprised for the audience is, you know, I feel like I'm having to put on my acting cap, mm-hmm. when it's a script that I know and I know exactly what's coming, but the audience doesn't know. And so for him to, you know, be able to show his shock and disappointment in that moment, I was like, God damn, that's well done. Like, good for you.
Yeah. You know, like, it was the one thing they could do to completely eviscerate him.
Mm-hmm.
Other than killing him,
sure.
was his one desire, aside from squashing the rebellion, was to see that, you know, that boy born, raised in his shadow, and just continue the legacy. And she took it away from him with one word.
Right, and the killing, he's not. I don't think he's too bothered by, because like you were saying earlier about his second in command or whatever he was that was a little nervous or apprehensive hiding behind the trees. And he's saying, you know, he's basically throwing himself into the fray. Right.
this is a good way to die.
Yeah. And so I don't think that the him dying was as important as making sure, okay, yes, his son is born, and you make sure you tell him this. And she says, no.
Right. I am not going to, bog this kid's life down with another legacy of trying to, you know, best your father. It's not going to happen. This kid is not even going to know your name.
Yeah, he won't know your name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when they shoot him, did you notice how the eye above the bullet hole?
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, kind of turns back and gets all bloodshot. It's like, oh, jeez.
I do love it when they choose not to do the sort of typical between the eyes shot.
Right. Right, it was an atypical way to do it. Right?
Yeah, it was almost like, I don't know if you're familiar with The Shield, the TV series.
I've never seen it. I hear good things.
Yeah, it's very good. In the pilot episode, there's a character that's shot in that same spot, and it's just kind of like, okay, it's accepted that they're dead. They don't go to the lengths of having the sort of blood run up into the eye and the eye roll back.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched that and was like, wow, that's a really nice detail that they decided to put in there.
Yeah, and it also reveals the ugliness of the character that, you know, we saw
yeah.
through his actions, but it's almost as if all that ugliness that he had inside just, because let's be honest, the guy's a handsome dude.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Sergi Lopez. A very handsome guy, rugged, you know, I could see him as, you know, the good guy in say like an action series. He looks the part. But when he gets shot, it's almost as if it let loose all that blackness inside him. Cause when he goes down, he is not looking good.
He's got one side of his face torn up and the other one's blown up.
Right. He looks monstrous. He looks like Quasimodo, like the bell ringer. He looks like a misshapen, you know, subhuman beast, and that's the way he should look.
Yeah, speaking of attractive actors in the film, Ivana Baquero, who mm-hmm. played Ophelia, she's grown up a bit.
Just a little.
She looks pretty good.
She is stunning.
Yes, she is.
I checked out her IMDb entry. She is a beautiful girl.
Yes, yeah. She is.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, as a child, I don't want to get into ickiness, but I mean, she is a beautiful child as well.
Sure, and I do think that you are right on with the fact that she has this sort of, it's almost like an otherworldliness, which is mm-hmm. hard for me to say, but she has that sort of quality where she could be in a fantasy style film and look regal.
Right.
You know, she has that sort of air about her as a young child.
Well, in the commentary, didn't Del Toro say that he was completely enamored with the child and basically wrote the part for her?
Yeah, I believe that that's right.
Yeah.
I didn't listen to it right before recording, but I think the last time I watched it, I did, which was about I want to say like 16, 18 months ago or so.
Yeah. Are you a fan of supplementary?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Me too. I cannot get enough of them. And every time Jason says, I don't even, you know, check out that stuff, it just, it breaks my heart. It reveals so much insight into the making of these things. I mean, they don't spring up from nowhere. People, yeah. You know, human beings work on these.
You bring that up to Wood every time he talks about supplemental material in a chat or
and he never watches them or reads the back matter. It's like, oh, my heart. What are you doing?
That's hard. You know, one of my favorite memories is you know, hanging out with friends in college and just having talks about after school and what we want to do, you know, with careers and family and that sort of thing while the Lord of the Rings commentaries were on.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Just so listening to them talk about the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of the thing that marked me. And so I remember after listening to some of them, only buying movies for a long time that had some sort of commentary or some sort of behind the scenes making of. And it's sort of saddening when you get a disc from Netflix or so, and it's like, oh, you know, for supplemental material, see disc 2. And you're like, oh, F you.
I know. It's such a letdown. Some of my favorite commentaries have absolutely nothing to do with the production of the film.
Mm.
But, it has the principal people involved with the film, the director, you know, a couple of the stars. But the movie's playing in the background, and they are talking about something so far removed from the movie. I mean, it's not even funny. I love those kind of commentaries because while it's not about the movie per se, it's about the people that made the movie. So
yeah.
it still offers insight into, you know, the decision-making process and how they, you know, came up with these pieces of art. So I don't think there's ever a bad commentary or a useless commentary. Let's just say that.
Yeah. Some of them are better than others. Clearly. Like I know that the ones that I'm not huge into are, where they're just sitting kind of watching the movie with you and you can tell that they're just laughing at parts that are supposed to be funny. And you're like, well,
right.
You're not doing it. You're not contributing anything.
Yeah. You know? And you'll get sections where someone doesn't speak for, you know, 5 minutes or more. It's like, do you not know, you know, the purpose of a commentary? It's let's come on, fess up. Every scene has a story
mm-hmm.
on the production side, even if it's mundane, like, oh, the caterers were late, you know, right before sure. we shot this. So the actor was kind of, you know, uppity. Like even that is valuable.
Yeah.
But some of the commentaries I have, it's just like, you know, so much dead space. It's like, let's come on, fess up.
Yeah. For me, it's almost intimidating though, because I'll listen to some of the commentaries and I'll be like, wow, this guy is really smart.
Right.
You know, yes. And it's like, oh, when they're talking about, you know, and I know that some people are not a big fan of his, but I really like listening to Sam Mendes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that whether his films are fully successful or not is up for debate, but I think that he's a very intelligent person.
Right.
And so listening to him talk about, camera shots and techniques. And I remember listening to, the American Beauty and, the Road to Perdition commentaries and talking about why he chose what and what influenced him. And I'm sitting there watching it going, well, I don't know if this necessarily works, but damn, that's interesting that he's referencing all these different things while he's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really like that sort of thing. For me, I'm more into the commentary and the people talking because I use that time to pay bills, to do sort of the mundane thing, like folding laundry, like that sort of stuff, right?
Right.
I have commentaries on. It's harder for me when it's something like, again, using the Lord of the Rings example, when they're going through all of the matte paintings.
Right. Exactly. And you have to participate.
Yeah. And so you're sitting there and it's like, okay, well, specifically now for this show, it's like, well, I only have so many hours in the day. The little one only goes to bed on her own every once in a great while, and that's when she just falls asleep out of the living room with us. So it's like, I can only have, you know, a few hours to watch a couple things. Do I want to watch something new, or do I want to watch them talk about a matte painting or yes. talk about the computer effects? And so most of the time I'll go to something new. But then it saddens me because I'm like, oh, damn, I remember the time back in the day when I had all this free time and I could just sit and listen to whatever I wanted to or delve into the depths of how this was created.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that adds a lot. I mean, I think that, you know, I would imagine most comic book people, especially those that are into the artist's editions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or into all of the back matter, that they have to be fans of supplemental material.
Right. I think those things are essential. And I'm very familiar with what you were talking about because I don't know if you know this, but geez, it must be more than 10 years ago. I used to have a website where I reviewed DVDs and I would consume everything. If it was on the disc, I watched it because I thought it was, my job.
It's part of the experience, right?
Yeah, it was my job to report on everything, you know, all the content of the disc. And as the DVD, the methodology of jamming these discs with, you know, and when dual layers came out, forget it. Like there was so much content mm-hmm. on these discs where, I was a big fan of, and I still am, Something Weird Video. you know, God rest my grainy soul. And they are notable for just jamming their discs with so much content. And I would digest it all before I wrote the review. And there were times when I'm like, why am I doing this? You know, I've just spent 12 hours on this one disc and wrote maybe, you know, 1,200 words.
Yeah, especially if you're not fully in love with it. It does make you question, right?
That was the bad part. I mean, if you got to – and I've had friends that produce these things that I'm no longer friends with because I just chose not to review their things as opposed to, you know, being true, saying my honest-to-God opinions about their work. This movie shouldn't even be on DVD. Why are you including, like, 12 hours of bonus material with this? But yeah, it was fun.
I didn't do reviews like that, but I did do, I don't think we've talked about this, but I did do in, I think it was 2011, which seems like it was forever ago now, but it was, I did a movie a day.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I would write a review of whatever movie, and it had to be new to me. So I couldn't rewatch and so this was when I was married to my ex-wife. And so we had the agreement basically where we were, she was in one room and I was in another and that was fine. Yeah. Right. And so I had all this free time. And so I was like, I got to find a way to spend this free time. So I was like, okay, well, a buddy and I both decided to do a movie a day. And write about them. And a lot of the movies at the beginning were films, you know, that I just wanted to get around to seeing and this, that, and the other. And all the reviews were really pretty pithy and like, well, you know, this made me think of this and this is pretty good and blah, blah, blah. And then towards the end, it got a lot more into theme and a lot more in depth. And I found myself like going, why am I doing this? Like every single day.
Yep.
What's the point here? Especially when I started doing, more than one a day, because I ended up making it to 400 on the dot.
Oh my goodness. I can't even imagine that.
And so you get to find some pretty clear, shorthand that a lot of filmmakers are using.
Right.
That are just depending upon your experience with other films. Mm-hmm. And it's really frustrating at times.
Reviewing films is a thankless job.
Oh, absolutely. It is.
I can see, I mean, just speaking from experience, yeah, it's a great way to amass a huge movie library because, you know, you get screeners and that's cool. For me, it led to liner notes. I wrote a bunch of liner notes for Something Weird Video, but, all said and done, what do you get out of it?
Yeah.
It's fun. Yes, there's an entertainment aspect to it, but, and if you can parlay those reviews into maybe a book and make some money on that, that's great. But, all said and done, yeah, it's fun, but it really, you know.
What are you walking away with, right?
Yeah, right. Experience. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing too, is I was trying for the most part to find movies that I wanted to actually see. Mm-hmm. You know, because I watched a few that I was like, well, I bet this is going to be shitty. And how fun will this be to just make fun of it? And I saw a couple of those and was like, wow, that's not a good way to spend my evening at all.
No.
You know, and we have on the show have done a few of those themes for our months where we've talked about the biggest box office flops of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, okay, well, yeah, that'll be fun because, you know, Rachel, that is my regular co-host, she's funny and she comes up with all this different shit to say and it'll be a good time. And we got into it and, you know, we had a few comments where it's like, God, you guys just seemed like you were depressed the whole time. And we were, because it was like, oh, this movie was so terrible.
Yeah.
They wasted so much money. What were they doing?
I try not to publicly ridicule art. Like, I'm not a fan of the Mystery Science Theater 3000 or the riff tracks. I just don't get it. If you're going to deride somebody else's work, yeah, obviously you may come up with those, you know, things in your head, but there's no reason to make them real. Because, you know, human beings made this stuff. It may not be the best movie ever made, but it was while they were making it. So I'm not going to take it upon myself to, you know, bash the work of others. I just can't do it.
We try to stay constructive.
Right.
And try to say, well, you know, we recently, as a recording, we recently talked about the movie, The Giver, which is a young adult novel. Mm-hmm. That was turned into a movie, and it has, you know, it has Meryl Streep and Jeff Bridges, and we're like, oh, and to a lesser degree, Katie Holmes. We're like, okay, well, this could be something, right? And because we're, as of recording, doing a theme called What We Missed in 2014, and going over the movies that we wanted to see, but we just didn't get to, and that was one of the suggestions. And so we watched that, and we talked about how I'm sure the book was good and there was a lot of ideas that were good, but it's someone's job to translate this to the screen and it just wasn't effective as it could be.
Right.
And that's how, you know, we were trying to like not say, oh, it wasn't very good at all without saying it wasn't very good at all.
I think that's very fair. Yep.
And it's hard, especially with the idea that, you know, this is, the sort of setting is supposed to be, you watch a movie, you go to a bar, and you talk about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the general idea. Although Vince is violating the essence by having the coffee, but this that's the idea anyway. Is that it's, you know, you're just sitting with a buddy and talking about a movie that you just saw.
Right. And, you know? And come on, we do it with our friends. Oh man, that movie sucks.
Sure.
You know,
oh,
stay
sure.
away from it. But in, you know, in a public forum, that saying things like that, I don't think they do anybody any good. Mm. They make you look petty and, you know, just not someone you'd want to hang around with. And they, you know, they make the people concerned feel like crap.
Sure.
So yeah, you ward the people close to you away from these things, but there's no reason to make it real.
There you go.
I don't think so anyway.
That's some real talk. That has nothing to do with Pan's Labyrinth, by the way.
Right.
We went down a rabbit hole to where there's no Vince-like segue to get back.
Isn't that fun, though?
Well, yeah. That's the fun part about it.
Now we got to claw ourselves back to Pan's Labyrinth. You know, we should just end with saying it's a fantastic, multi-layered, vivid, magical film.
It really is. You know, it's a film that I hadn't seen in, like I said, about 18 months or so. And before that, I hadn't seen it since the initial watch. So I think I've only seen it 3 to maybe 4 times.
Mm-hmm. There are films I try and watch on a yearly basis, and Pan's Labyrinth is one of them. Just to remind me that, you know, magic in the cinema does exist. He captured something with this film that I think very few, movies, there's a content of wonder. Yes. And dread. And it's overall, it's a very sad film, but it's still a very magical film. And I think few people manage to get that on the screen.
I really like that. You know, I need to start doing that because I know that, one of your co-hosts, Mr. David A. Price, does that with the Lord of the Rings films.
Isn't that boggle your mind?
It does. That's a big undertaking every year.
Oh yeah, very worthwhile films, but the sheer expenditure of time is just like, I don't know if I'd be able to find time to watch.
Yeah,
and he doesn't. Right. I was just saying that he doesn't watch the regular cut. He watches the director's extended cuts.
Oh, that is a lot to do. I mean, you know, I mentioned this last time when you and I talked, but we put out in, I think it was, September maybe or October, but we put out finally the, 18 month journey into Lost, right? Mm-hmm. And all of the entire 6 seasons. And so it was a thing where we had a few comments and in some emails about when I was going to watch Lost again. And I said, well, yeah, I definitely would, but it's going to be a while. And I had a few people that said, oh, well, I watch it probably every other year. And I'm like, good Lord, that is so much. Like, that's almost on repeat.
Right.
It's like, there is a lot of things to digest out there that are worth your time. And don't get me wrong, I was a fan of the show. I know a lot of people, I think Vince included, didn't like the way that it ended. But I thought it was I thought it was successful, and I think that there was maybe a little bit of booze involved with my review of the last film or the last last season.
Yeah.
But it was also a lot of that sort of sense of this is the last I'm going to see of these characters and of this situation.
Right.
And that attachment. And, you know, I had some personal attachment to the series as well. And so I think that that's, important too. But, you know, what I'm getting around to is seeing a TV show like that or seeing something like The Lord of the Rings where there's such a span of time involved. Mm-hmm. I get that people have relation to, the material, but I mean, there's so much stuff that I want to see. I don't have enough time in the day.
Right. And now with our little devices make doing so much easier than it would be if, you know, you had to plop down in your living room and, you know, watch it the way we have always had to, like in front of this, you know, giant set. You can watch it on your phone if you really wanted to, or an iPad or, a Surface or something. So it is more conducive now to doing that, but I can't see. Like, I used to watch Twin Peaks every year religiously, the entire series, and I still do. My method of watching it was on Laserdisc.
Oh, okay. Sure.
There's only one place you're going to do that, and that's in your living room.
Right.
But now, you know, with DVDs and you can stream them and stuff.
You can't get the Laserdisc to fit into the iPad or?
No. I still have them. I loved Laserdisc. Oh.
Are you going to get, did you get that the new box set?
Yes, I did.
Oh.
I haven't cracked it yet.
You know what? What's interesting is we did a show, which Cameron Rice and I do, called Filmographies, and we did a show on David Lynch. Or, well, not a show. We went through his films three at a time.
Amazing.
And that was very interesting. And we had our mutual friend, your argument mate, Mr. Gabriel Hardman.
Ah.
We've had him on. We've had him on a couple of times, and Gabe always makes me feel less intelligent after the fact, because I'm like, oh, I don't know as much as Gabe does.
Well, he tries to. That's one of his goals.
I do enjoy Gabe quite a bit, but I do feel a little intimidated sometimes when he starts going on about things.
Right. I love that man.
Yes, he's a great guy. And we talked about, you know, he made us feel bad because we didn't understand Lost Highway. And then we talked about Twin Peaks, and we had our mutual friend Zach Crucy on there, and we talked about that quite a bit. And I am intrigued to watch that show again because I really enjoy. I fell into the trap of most people to where I really enjoyed the first season, and I enjoyed a lot of things about the second season, but I sort of lost the will to keep going at some point and was just like, okay, now I'm ready for it to be over. You know, until the very end. Then I was like, oh man, why is there not more of this? So.
Yeah. Well, second season is my favorite. So.
Is that really? Wow.
Yes. I love second season much more than the first, but there's a timelessness to Twin Peaks. That series is always going to work. Mm. It's like Mayberry. You know, you can watch those old Andy Griffiths, and yes, technology and society and just human beings have evolved past that. But it's Twin Peaks is like Mayberry in a sense that the stories, the characters, they're always going to work. There's nothing dated about Twin Peaks.
I like that.
Yep.
Hmm.
Like the Honeymooners.
I did really enjoy, I did really enjoy Fire Walk With Me, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah. A bit of a head scratcher when one considers that the identity of the killer was already divulged.
Yeah.
Let's make a movie about it. Let's show the complete and utter hopelessness this girl endured during her final days of life. It just didn't make sense to me. But I mean, I love the movie.
Yeah. Let's get back to Guillermo del Toro. What do you think about him as a filmmaker in general? Because I know that you've kind of come around a bit to Pacific Rim, but I wouldn't necessarily expect that to be one of your favorite films.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think about him as a whole?
Because
I have a little bit of, like, I don't know. I want to really love it.
I think he wears two hats when he makes films. They're the ones he makes for himself. Like The Devil's Backbone
and Kronos,
and Kronos and Pan's Labyrinth. And then there's the films he makes to gain notoriety or a wider audience like Hellboy and Pacific Rim. I'm not a huge fan of Hellboy.
The first one. Yeah, that's really interesting, because that's almost, you would think, oh, well, what do you mean? Vince is a comic guy. Of course he has to love Hellboy.
Yeah, I don't think Hellboy captures anything. I shouldn't say that. I don't think Hellboy captures very much of the Mignola
verse. Like the essence.
The essence of what Mike was doing on paper, I think it falls way short of capturing that. The Golden Army comes a lot closer, I think. But still, it's like, your auteur making art house films who gets a job directing a TV show. Yeah. I see Hellboy and Pacific Rim as his mainstream stuff, and then there's, like I said, the films that he makes purely out of a sense that he needs to purge himself of these stories and get them as visually close on the screen as to the way they are in his head. Mm-hmm. That's like Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, that's his unofficial trilogy, right? With Kronos and the Devil's Backbone and Pan. I think I'm pretty much with you. I didn't realize how similar he is to a Steven Soderbergh type of a director, to where it's one for you, one for me.
Right. And you look at the work that he does on his own, like with his sketchbooks and his drawing. I mean, the man is masterful and comprehensive and considers everything. And he's very intelligent and loves to make movies, loves genre films, loves the fantasy worlds and those characters. And yet, I mean, he's a huge fan of Richard Corbin, and he owns original art, which makes me insane.
I was going to say, how much does that kill you?
so he is at one time a fan and he's an artist. So his heart's in the right place. And that's what I said about Pacific Rim. The heart was there. Just the presentation initially left a lot to be desired. But now I've let it sink in and I see, yeah, some of the kaiju designs aren't really that bad. I've warmed up to it. But yeah, he's still like Ophelia and the princess, he's working in two different dimensions with his films.
Yes. Now, what is interesting to me, to where he had a fairly regular schedule for a while. Like, he had Kronos in 93, then he did his US debut with Mimic in 97, and that was a little bit of a gap. But then he does, again, one for him with Devil's Backbone, and follows it up immediately with Blade 2 in 2002, and then goes Hellboy 2004, Pan in 2006, Hellboy 2 in 2008. So he's got a nice little rhythm going, right? Then he takes 5 years to make Pacific Rim from 08 to 2013. And then he directs one of the episodes of a series that I know that you enjoy that he produced, which was The Strain in 2014. And his next film is in post-production now, and it is supposed to come out this fall of 2015. And it is called Crimson Peak.
Right.
And it is a horror film with Charlie Hunnam from Pacific Rim and Jessica Chastain, which I love, and Mia Wasikowska and Tom Hiddleston, who's better known as Loki to a lot of people, and Doug Jones again,
right,
who played the Fawn. So I think that will be interesting to see him go back to horror after doing the sort of hard sci-fi of Pacific Rim.
Right.
Although I feel like it may have, I don't know, I feel like it'll be interesting, but it's a little on the safe side as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, okay, well, I've seen him do horror always.
Right.
You know?
Well, I mean, in retrospect or in hindsight, Pacific Rim is a really smart move for him to make. Because while not initially, I mean, it didn't make a ton of money. But it did manage to gain a rabid fan base.
People that love it, love it.
Right. and through that, he's already confirmed that, yes, there will be a sequel.
Yes.
I mean, it was a little touch and go there for a while. But, yeah, there will be a sequel. And there's going to be an animated series.
Mm.
And when you look at the sheer amount of action figures that were produced for that movie, like all of the Jaggers and the Kaiju, and there's different sizes of each one. Like it's a money making machine. I don't know how much, but I'm sure it makes a nice amount of bank for himself. And Nika makes the figures. So yeah, it was a smart decision, but I still prefer him when he's making the films for himself.
Yeah, what do you think of this? Now, this is, I know you have talked about the French version of this story, but what do you think of the, he's announced to be coming out with an animated / fantasy version of Pinocchio?
Oh, I think that'd be, I didn't even hear, when was that announced?
It's on his IMDb page. He's the director along with Mark Gustafson. And they have a poster for it, and the tag is a darker version of the classic children's fairy tale of a wooden puppet that transforms into a real living boy.
Now, is this adapted from the Pinocchio graphic novel we talked about?
I don't believe so. I think this is it's from Carlo Coyote, maybe? That's character's novel, and the writer is Gris Grimley, and the screenplay and story is by Matthew Robbins and Guillermo del Toro.
Wow, I think it sounds great.
And so he is listed as co-director along with Mark Gustafson, who I'm not familiar with what he's done before, really.
Yeah, I'm on board for that.
Yeah, so that's announced, but I don't believe that they have started that yet.
See, he just loves to work in two realms.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
Again, Pinocchio, the puppet that wanted to be a real boy. Mm-hmm. So, oh man, that's incredible. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, so we'll see. We'll see how that, if that ends up, you know, coming down the pike or not, or if it's a little Hobbit-like, where, you know, he's done a lot of work for it, but it doesn't have his name on it,
yeah,
sort of a thing. So
and major props for the strain too.
Oh yeah, I know that you guys were talked about that a lot for a while, and then I didn't hear you say much about it. Are you just waiting for season two now? Or?
Yeah, I can't wait. vampires are a really hard sell with me, and he managed to hook me.
And remind me, did you get into the books, into the comics?
Jason did. Okay. Yeah, I have yet to dip my toe into those. I'm just going to scoop them all up at once. The final series is still being produced now, and I'm thinking they're going to collect that. When that's done, I'll grab them all.
There you go. That's smart.
Because I don't want any spoilers.
Of course.
Yeah, for the TV show.
Yeah. All right, Vince. Well, do you have anything else about Pan's Labyrinth that we may have skipped over? Or I know we went down some rabbit holes. So is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we close this one out?
No, I think we covered it fairly thoroughly. I can still hear the lullaby in my head.
Oh, well, they'll be hearing it probably about now as I put it in as the exit song. So nice. If people have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for this show, for Podshots, you can email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter. Our handle is @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @EricWilliam79. You could also follow our co-host, Rachel. She doesn't really know how to do the Twitter so well, but her handle is @LadyZlag. We also have a Facebook page for the show. You could like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com and you could search for our wish list. Over there, it is full of movies that we want, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies. If you're in the giving mood, just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. So I do want to thank Vince once again for coming on and discussing Pan's Labyrinth. If people wanted to hear more from Vince, they could check out our previous discussion on Godzilla. But if people wanted to hear more from you individually or get in contact with you, where could they find you?
Well, it's always 11oclockcomics.com. We're on the iTunes. Just search for 11 o'clock comics. And I'm on the Facebooks more than I'd like to admit. Vince Bond and @VinceBond on Twitter.
All right. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.